Hello, ladies and gentlemen of the Last Podcast on the Left Patreon. God, it's good to see you. I mean, I can't see you. I can't really see anything. I have a blindfold on. I'm in an undisclosed location. This is Henry Zabrowski. But you know who's not? It's my esteemed guest. Someone that is out here. I mean, because he can't be in hiding because he is on a promotional tour. And he has to be out there. He's in four. And I'm certain he'd rather be asleep. But he's excited about the movie. No, I see the eagerness in his face. He's excited about the film. Yes. We're going to get into the meat of it. This is William Brent Bell, the director of some of our favorite movies on Side Stories and Last Podcast. We've talked about The Boy several times. Where also has come up quite a bit, which I also, it's a great movie. But most importantly, this, your newest film, Orphan 2, First Kill, which I'm very excited for. I'm excited for the world to see. Thank you so much for being here, William Brent Bell.
Thank you so much for having me. And obviously you can call me Brent.
I will. It's for Googles.
Absolutely. And no, it's great to be here. You know, I don't really want to be asleep, but no, like being out in front of things in a publicity way is not necessarily, you know, where I usually am. I'm always behind the camera. So watching the girls, watching Julie and Isabel doing press this week, you know, I'm just like, ah, they make me look so bad.
Well, that's their job. And you have to be, remember who made you Orphan? Yeah. You always say that to the actors.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been fun. It's already been fun.
Can I ask you, right? So number one, we'll get into the film. I'm excited about this because it's a prequel. Because at first I was just like, how are we doing the sequel to Orphan? Because not, again, spoilers, let's just say Orphan doesn't fare very well at the end of the first movie.
Her neck takes a turn for the worse.
Yeah. She gets what she deserves.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
But my question is, man, what do you have against children?
You know, I guess I just think that they're kind of up to no good. Kids remain pretty, a lot of kids remain really quiet, you know.
Yes.
Kids are wild, but those ones are too obvious. It's the quiet ones who I know hear everything. And, you know, I mean, I knew when I was a kid, you know, our strongest memories of things like movies are well before 10. And yet adults look at a kid 6 to 10 and, you know, they don't realize how smart kids are. And I still remember how conniving we were as kids.
I was a kid. I was very much so into everything that was spooky and dark, but it also used to terrify me. So essentially, I mean, I would torture my parents because all I'd want to see was whatever is the creepiest thing. And they were like, oh, like, and I'd read it too. Cause I started reading Stephen King when I was like 10 years old.
Yeah.
Like, and it was probably it's far too young.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
But I'm reading it. My mom did the thing. Well, at least he's reading, but she doesn't know that I'm up all night, like terrified by my own imagination.
Yeah. I mean, I've been thinking about this a lot lately, and I was terrified too. And I saw movies way too young, and it's what my parents did when, as a product of divorce, they sat me in front of the television and I ended up watching scary stuff. My sister made sure I did. She was like 4.5 years older, that perfect age where she hated me, but also kind of was torturing me by having me watch Halloween and stuff as a kid.
Yeah,
but it's great. And so while I have I have stronger memories about horror films before the age of 10 than I do about like my regular life.
Me too, man. The house. I was obsessed with movie House.
Oh yeah,
as a little boy, and now I rewatch as an adult, and I was like, it's a very weird toned film.
I mean, there's a lot that we were allowed to watch that had very weird tones, and books that were written back then, like you said, Stephen King. But I mean, you know, bestsellers back in the late 60s and early 70s, when, you know, it was such a heyday for horror. Also, people were buying Jaws or, you know, The Other, or these amazing books that turned into horror films. It's not like that really necessarily more, except for kind of the more straightforward horror like Stephen King or Peter Straub, you know.
Is that how you found yourself into direct? Because you've directed a lot of horror. Like, do you feel that you are like, because then I feel like some guys get a little bit like, well, I'm a director. I'm not a horror director, but do you feel that you're like a horror guy?
I mean, I'm from Lexington, Kentucky. I'm always going to be from Lexington. I'm a horror guy. Like, it's just part of my DNA.
Some guys get umbrage. Because I've talked with directors about this, and sometimes you're like, well, I'm a director. You know, and you're like, no, I know, but you've done only horror films. And they're all like, but you wait until I do my final, you know, Rob Zombie. I love him. He wanted to do the hockey comedy. You know what I mean? That he can't seem to get going.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's in between movies, sometimes more than others. It's like, it'll always be like, well, what's next? And then there'll be like some science, never rom-coms or straight dramas, but there'll be, science fiction ideas or, you know, things that are in the realm, but not straight horror. And then I just find myself gravitating right back towards horror. And because to me, of course, it's such a wide spectrum of story styles that a lot of people who aren't as familiar with horror, they have a preconceived notion in their mind of what they think it is. And it can be any number of things. Usually it's either ghost stories or slashers, like, and that's about all they kind of connect it to. But, you know, it's so much more.
Oh, and yeah. So, the genre, especially in the last couple of years, has really shown just how beautiful and varied horror genre is. Horror genre, because you can, like, it can be drama at its highest order. I just recently rewatched The Witch, too. And then you, like, watch something like that, and you're like, and that's a historical drama, because we're on last podcast, we're doing the Salem Witch Trials, and you see just how much work he put into that movie to make it, like, a real piece of history. Like,
listening to them talk in that old English style. At first, it's like, what is this? Like, I don't get. And then you're just, okay, I'm immersed in a world where people all talk this way. And you have to perk up and pay attention and to enjoy that movie. And I know I've seen stuff where he's kind of ashamed of that movie or something.
He's crazy. Like, well, he said the same thing about The Northman, too. He also was trying to walk back The Northman because he was like, oh, you know, it's an action movie. And I was like, yes, it is. Yes, it is. It's so wonderful.
But saying that he had trouble, like, oh, I didn't know how to tell a story when I did The Witch. I was like, you just need to calm down, look at it again, because you've told a brilliant story.
A beautiful story.
Beautiful story. Yeah.
Do you the same as a director? Is that the thing? Like, do you watch your own work? Like, when you go, like, do you watch it afterwards? Do you like it still? Or you're like, I never want to see Boy 2 again.
Oh, that's good. That's a specific one.
I love Brahms too. Don't worry. You're about to get a series of boy questions. I mean,
every movie, you know, Ron Howard, I saw something where he said, you know, being a director, every movie is going to break your heart at some point. Yeah. And it's really true, but it's also kind of like, I guess I don't have kids, but you know, movies are kind of like your kids. Like, you can't really choose necessarily. And I always know what the intentions were, or I know the behind the scenes or the politics. So I look at a movie that I've done sometimes with rose colored glasses, because I might not see it just the way a normal public viewing audience would see it. You know, I've got all the other scenes on my Avid, or I've got,
all the movies it could have been. You see all of the different movies.
Yeah. And something like like Brahms in particular was one that I've never had a situation where, you know, at the last second, the studio came in and completely changed the movie, sort of. And
really?
Oh, yeah. And, but that wasn't the only kind of problem with that movie, but it was definitely the biggest problem. Because, you know,
I bet.
And it happens.
How does that process happen? Because, like, I do want to just talk about Love of the Boy. I want to ask this. But, like, in terms of that, like, because I've never made, I've made independent films. I've always been on the talent side of it versus, like, the creating part of it, like, and the editing. So when you submit your film, so is that idea? It's like when the studio comes and change everything, like, did you hand them, like, all right, we're done. Guys, we did all of our work. Is it like that where you get a picture lock and you do all of your own sounds and posts? Is all the posts done too by the time you send it to the network, and then they just do whatever they want with it?
I mean, it's slightly different, you know, depending on the movie and where it is. Like we may like the film I just did in London, Lord of Misrule, with Ralph Ineson from The Witch. You know,
man, he's on fire, dude. He's on fire. What a fantastic actor!
And wait till you see him in this movie because it's the most complete character since The Witch. I mean, he's you know, it's a full character in the movie. You know, that movie, I'm locking picture this next week or two, and finishing the sound mix and stuff like that. But we haven't sold it to a distributor. So when the distributor comes on board, they may crack the movie back open and you never know. And it's usually
seriously, they can do that? Like the distributor does that?
Well, no, they do it with me. It's kind of like, you know, it's with every movie. It's like, well, now let's spend some more money on this, or let's try this, or have you thought about this? And it usually is a good thing. And sometimes, you know, I go through the whole process. It's not just my cut. It's every cut I oversee and the sound mix and every aspect. But in the case of that movie, Brahms in particular, the company that was producing the film went bankrupt after 30 years making tons of movies, you know, Lakeshore. They made Underworld. They made Million Dollar Baby, a million things. And they just, you know, it just, they were too big and, they went under. So all of a sudden you had no producers, and then the studio just kind of cracked it open and they're like, we want to make some changes because they thought,
oh my God. And then you're like, basically your production company daddy is gone.
Exactly.
Like the person that was supposed to be cradling this through, that person whose project it was. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
And so after I watched it, I was like, have you guys seen what they did? No, actually, we've not seen it. Like, we don't have, like, they're not involved anymore. So it was just literally, you never know when a movie can get tweaked in this huge, long process. And that's why I'm so paranoid all the time, paying attention, you know? I mean, it was the same way Devil Inside was that way. Like, there was a tweak after a year of beating up that movie and testing it so many times. At the last second, the president of the studio made a change that went down in, you know, kind of movie history as a, you know, putting up that card at the end of The Devil Inside was a last second idea that the only thing we never tested in that movie. And he even, you know, told me later that he made a mistake. He meant for that card to happen after the credits, but it was like, you didn't say that. And it was one of the last directives that the studio asked us to do anyway. It just changes. You know, it can affect the whole...
Oh, the entire movie. Because the ending is one of the most important parts of the movie. Because it's what the audience is the last thing they see.
Yeah.
And so it's the last memory they have of what they thought.
It's difficult. I mean, I'm not complaining. It's just, it's tricky.
It's a lot.
And especially if you're trying to do movies that are going to be seen by a lot of people, you know, then you've got a lot more money involved and a lot more politics because people are very worried about that money and... the marketing.
Oh, very much so.
So then, you know, juggling.
And then you can have your whole $90 million movie thrown in the trash for no reason that you worked on for a year. And now it can just go away. It was already done. I mean, that's a shock. I've been texting with every person I know in the film industry that were
there's no way that's going to stick. You know, I mean, I feel like we've seen lately, especially, and I don't think this is what they're doing, but there is, you know, where they'll send out kind of negative, you know, like, oh, we're going to be low in cherries this year for the, you know, food season. And then everybody goes out and wants to buy cherries. But it was like, they were never going to be low on cherries. So like, all of a sudden we're talking about Batgirl. Like it's the must-see
movie of the year. No, it does work. Everyone, it's true. Because then everyone's like, now I got to see this movie.
Absolutely.
And then you're like, and then we're all going to sit there for the 95 minutes of essentially a CW show and just be like, well, I'm glad. How I feel is I'm just glad that everybody gets paid and everybody's work gets seen. To me, it's like, I just know that how many, the most talented artisans in the world get paid all of this money just to have their work shelved. I really do feel for the people making the costumes. And all of that shit, you know.
Like I said, I really believe, knock on wood, in the system or whatever, that that movie can't be gone, you know. And they're going to see all this groundswell. And I don't understand why it now, you know, like why you don't release it on HBO Max. But
it makes no sense. I don't know. It seems like it's already done.
It's, you know, it's fascinating.
Live from your grave.
A roast as dark as the night.
perfect for fueling the cryptid research and mad ravings required for your podcasting. Don't mind the red eyes. He's just trying to warn you of the bridge.
The bridge.
Finally, from the caffeine-addled brains of Springheel Jack Coffee and Last Podcast on the Left, we bring you Mothman's Red Eye Blend. Yes, delicious Panama beans. Go to lastpodcastmerch.com to order yours today.
So I wanted to ask, so we actually, it was kind of funny that because when we got, we were talking about like, because you were out here promoting the film, but we actually just had this conversation on our show about the difference between literally orphan and The Boy, about how that it's kind of like it was a jokey conversation, but the breakdown of like, no, one's an evil child turned adult movie. One is a object treated as child movie, and that you can't know the ending of The Boy because you don't want to do it. But like, but my question is, what do you see as like the difference between these things? Like idea of like in the subgenres of horror, how do you break them apart?
You know, what's interesting is I would probably say that, you know, the comparison's more Brahms, the guy in the walls, to Esther, you know?
Yeah, well, that was why in the show, we didn't want to spoil the ending of The Boy who hadn't seen it. Like we were like, but now this is Patreon. So you're going to have to know that like The Boy's not The Boy.
Yeah. And so the sociopath or the psychopath, the human, it's really just about what sliver of their life story we see. So in The Boy, yes, we see the story we see, which is mostly about these parents, their coping mechanism. Right. And then we reveal like it wasn't just a coping mechanism. There's more to it. Same thing with, you know, Orphan. It's like, she's a little girl, but she's not. She's actually this adult sociopath. We've just never delved as much into Brahms's story as we've seen her do now two full movies and seen a couple sides to her. So there's a lot of similarities to me, certainly on like the things that get me excited about horror.
Well, I like anything, The Innocent on its head is one of the, you know, it's a part of horror forever. But like when you went to go to design The Boy,
yeah,
like
the doll.
Yes, the doll, The Boy. Like how many options did you go through and how did you choose what the optics were? Because it was another kind of conversation we've had ongoing on Last Podcast about like Annabelle, right? How I actually prefer sort of like the actual Annabelle, which was a Raggedy Ann doll, yeah, and it's super plain. And then the movie one, they make it a little bit more elaborate, where I think The Boy is a really good down the middle. Like it's just a good old fashioned creepy porcelain boy.
Well, you know, and that to me is scarier than if that boy was making an evil face and
yes,
had, you know, forget the fact that obviously Annabelle was in the zeitgeist around them as well. So whenever the studio wanted me to make him look scarier.
Is that a note that they give you? Like when you show up?
Yeah. Like make him scary. Shouldn't he? But I'm like, no, it's like, you know, Damien from The Omen or the two twin brothers from The Other, or these characters are cherubic, like sweet kids, but they're holding like a knife behind their back. And if you get close enough, they'll slit your throat. And so I tried really hard to make him look as those dolls did in that time, you know, kind of beautiful and innocent. And, but you know, we used real fake eyeballs, like eyeballs, you know,
yeah,
the changes and the variations in developing him, you know, it was super intense and it was.
I bet.
I think it was the when we did the camera test 3 days before shooting, his hair was terrible. It looked like he looked like a male figure skater. He had this like long, his hair was like, had these wings, and that wasn't like what the design was, but it's what the wig looked like. And so the night before we're in there, like, you know, having them cut his hair a certain way, going, oh, this is a nightmare. Like if he shows up like that, it changes everything. But then, and it turned out good. Like on the shooting day, he was like, that's the hair we wanted.
Do you treat The Boy like he's a little cast member? Like, is it like, do you have to like do like set the tone? Like when you're doing something scary like that, like how do you make everybody kind of feel the weight of it? Or do people like goof around? Because I feel like there's kind of different ways people run horror sets where like it's on one side of it's super extreme. It tends to be like a lighter set.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, he was kind of treated like a cast member for sure. I mean, and you know, here's what's funny about him on set. You know, he has different looks based on what's happening in the story, especially in the second when he was in the dirt. But he's over there and we put him in a chair and I've got great, like, you know, behind the scenes photos of him. But but not only is he just sitting there waiting to go on camera. And of course, you get used to it and you feel like he is a cast member. But like based on like how his hair was, we needed it to, you know, like be style a certain way, so he would have little clips in his hair, like so that his hair would, you know, curve a certain way when he let the clips down, so it would be like he would be waiting with rollers, you know, in between take. So it wasn't heavy or anything, but it wasn't like goofy. It was like, and yeah, he was careful with him, you know, because he's somewhat fragile depending on which version of him he is. But yeah, you know, he's and he just sitting there, you know, getting lit for a scene, the other actors are across from him and it's really no different. You know, it's kind of like a stand-in, except there is no person to fill the space. It's just him.
Because you're, as an actor, you're supposed to, technically you've been given the directive of like, well, like I love the interplay of the, that's what's so good about the boy is the, is he real? Like that feeling of like, you know, like you could watch them kind of play that process of as he became real.
Yeah.
Which is pretty great.
Yeah.
How did Brahms, the second one, prepare you to do this new movie? So Orphan First Kill. So this is like, so you've done a sequel or like, mm-hmm. Yeah. How does this prep you? Like, I mean, obviously they are different structures, but like, is there something about like, cause you didn't make the first Orphan. How do you like continue that story?
Well, you know, one thing that's great is the first movie holds up so well, you know, and yeah. I mean, there's a quality to it that's dated that we kind of wanted to partly lean into, both in the look and sound of it. But and it had such an exceptional level of casting, you know, for a horror film, for a movie then. So you're like, OK, we have to some degree the answers to the test, you know, especially when Isabel was officially on board. And we knew, you know, and I knew like, other than the technical aspects of making her believable or, you know, in the story, we have, you know, the actress who knows better than anybody, you know, how to bring to life his character. But as far as the look and feel, it's like, part of it is like, when in doubt, look at the original film, you know?
Yeah.
That with casting, you know, like bringing on Julia to me was a really like, it's the same kind of level as Vera Farmiga, you know? And it's like, when it was just normal creative conversations and people are like, oh, what about this casting choice? And it's like, that doesn't really live up to what the original film was. So always going back and pointing to the original movie because it was so good and being able to lean on it on every level to make sure that, you know, we're doing things more in a unique way from the original film, but at the same time, it still needs to be that DNA. So, and the boy movies definitely prepared me for that for many reasons, because it's similar. There's a lot of similarities, you know, in the look and style.
I feel like in the tone, there's like, there is similarity in tone, which is like, I feel like it actually does allow you to move pretty much directly from the boy to Orphan.
Yeah.
Live from your grave.
Hey, what's up, everyone? How you doing? Ben Kissel here with Henry Zebrowski.
Yeah, it's me, man.
Yeah, bro. Henry Zebrowski is smoking some of that sweet last podcast on the left, babe. So go out there and purchase yourself some. I hope you enjoy it. We have sativa, we have indica, and we have a hybrid. And I have to tell you, from my personal experience, they are wonderful.
Super tasty live resin. You really get the delicious, weedy taste, which is what I like. And three different experiences. You go to your local vape store and get it.
Absolutely. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. We absolutely love you. Can't wait to see you on the road and get that vape, put it in your brain, and have a good time.
And if you want us at your favorite weed store, give them a call and ask for them by name. Absolutely. Last podcast on the left, it's weed.
Hail yourselves, everyone.
Hail Satan.
Well, do you feel like now that there has been, we talked about this a little bit before, and you said that people have brought this to your attention, the story of Natalia Grace,
yeah,
that was this story that we covered on Side Stories quite a bit, but a real tiny person,
yeah,
pretending to be a child.
Yeah. Like I said, you know, Inventing Anna, these right now, it's so popular to watch movies and series in particular about these charlatans, you know, whether they're creating WeWork or you know, something like the Inventor, and then
I think the love of the con man is a slightly American aspirational idea, because I think it kind of brings up the idea of, like, it's the very core of the make money from nothing.
Yeah, I mean,
American ideal.
Yeah, fake it till you make it. And then what always fascinates me about those stories, and a story like Natalia Grace, and a story like Esther or Lena, is like these sociopaths, you know, on different levels, and they all are. Like, what are you thinking? Like, what do you think is the end game here? Because you can't sustain this. Eventually, you're not, like Natalia Grace, you're not going to grow up. And then they're going to be like, what's going on?
What's your deal? Yeah. Like when you cut her hanging out, playing dominoes and smoking shit. Like she's like that character from The Simpsons.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, which I love.
And it's, yeah. So to me, I'm just like, yeah, you know, like I get it as a means to an end, maybe, you know, like with Esther, you know, getting to America. It's a great way to get to America and to slip through whatever people were looking for this, an adult. And so she slips through the cracks as a child. But how long, you know, do you think that can last? And how many times are you going to continue to do that same thing? And I feel like with the characters like this, their lives are probably very painful as normal adults. And
yeah,
so they slip into these lies. But like I said, those lies aren't sustainable. So when are you going to learn from the lesson?
A lot of times when you see these guys, especially pathological liars, people that have we see it's like some version of an antisocial personality disorder, like whatever is under that umbrella. A lot of times it's the only way that they feel anything. Like they legitimately have a block. They only feel, they feel nothing. Like there's nothing registers. And the only thing that does register is upping the stakes of your current life. Like you do things where you try to fuck with the system because it gives you a reaction finally.
Yeah. And, you know, it's kind of the reverse of something like, is it Munchausen syndrome? Is that where you were, you know, where you poisoned your own child? Is that
they've got the two different, Munchausen by proxy. I believe that it's like the idea that you have it's the mom keeping the kids sick, kid kind of leaning into the, you know, it's this sort of inner world of just mental illness.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And so, you know, someone like Natalia Grace, it's like, as an adult, is she ridiculed in some way that is just really hurt? But as a child, she gets to be the smartest kid in the room. And
oh yeah, she gets
that
to crush
feels
it.
Great. You know? Yeah. She's, you know, she's brilliant. And it's the same way with Esther, you know, she's, you know, and we talked about like Esther's past. I mean, she's 31 in this movie, 33 in the other. So she's got 20 years in back until she's supposed to be, you know, but like, did she go to college? Did she try to go to college? And did she, you know, was she 28 and fell in love with her TA, her, you know, teacher's assistant but got laughed out of that or something. And, you know, like, and then decided, okay, I'm going to go back to acting like I'm a kid again. Like, who knows how many times she tried to become a normal person and it just didn't work out. And being a kid
exactly
way to do it.
People positioned her already as a little kid. I think that there is a little bit of that too, where she looks like a child. Mm-hmm. And so people kind of treat you as such.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you said,
she just deals with it
like a really brilliant child.
Yeah. Like, so you get nothing but positive validation.
Yeah.
Again.
Yeah.
Have you ever thought about this? Now, maybe this is out of the box, but have you thought about maybe doing a tie-in to the Orphan 2 First Kill, where you go to orphanages and try to find and suss out these fake children, and that you do it yourself. You and Isabella go from orphanage to orphanage, and you get three of them with the pair of parents, right? And you try to find out which is the secret adult.
It's like a dating show. Who's the fake child? Who's the fake orphan? That's something we haven't thought about. And it's like, it is one of those great, like, outside the box ideas in a publicity scenario.
I think that we should try it. No, I'm going to put money into this.
Well, what's interesting to me is because there's more than Talia Grace. It's like,
oh yeah,
how many, especially adopted orphans from another country who are coming in as even at 12, but they're actually 18, you know, how much of that is actually happening? And how many of those girls, you know, bless their hearts, are hoping maybe I will sleep with the dad and get a green card and, you know, those types of things.
That's rough. Oh, yeah. I'll tell you what, man. I don't believe that. I actually think that it's up to 75% of orphans are fake.
Yeah. Well, especially.
Yeah, I'm that close. I think 75 to 90% of orphans are adults pretending to be children. And that's, I wish we could stop it. I wish we could stop it.
You mean they still could grow up? Not necessarily they have a condition that will keep them a child forever.
Oh, no. That's why they have to wipe out the parents.
Yes.
They have to wipe out their own parents so they just get in there and then restructure and then become somebody else's orphan.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's not that far, you know, from other scenarios that we know are very real, you know.
I think so. Do you think that between the boy and orphan is the reason why you don't have children?
I think
because you just can't trust them.
Yeah, that's part of it in a way.
Yeah. You know what it did for me and my wife was we need to talk about Kevin.
Yeah. Yeah.
That stopped it because we were like, we're good. We're relatively normal and you could still make a crazy one.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, it's a cross between either them being crazy or, you know, they could, you know, I could have easily been very, you know, depressed and just sad. Yeah, you know. I joke, like I tried to kill my stepmother once. Now this is not really, but like when I was like, she was like kind of a step monster to me. And so I put hairspray on her toothbrush when I was like 6 years old.
Unbelievable. trust these kids. No, I cannot trust a child.
Yeah,
I think it's what we know for certain.
Well, it's certainly, very scared of them. It's certainly what these stories are leaning into, you know, that fear that you can't trust a child or you can't even trust that a doll's not maybe real or that it doesn't have a life when the lights go out. You know, I mean, there's a lot of aspects of that.
It creeps me out, man, because I have one of these, like I have this like Chucky mask above, oh, yeah, like right on the side of me. And it sits in a way that it's right above my chair. And so when I come, if I have to go to the bathroom at night or whatever to come out, it freaks me out 2 or 3 times a week. Like I see it. Like, oh, yeah.
Well, and that's part of the fun, too, like with horror of, you know, creating scenarios that feel grounded in a fairly normal life to where, you know, when you leave the movie, you're not off the hook, you know, you still,
yeah.
Or when you finish watching the movie, you know, you still in the middle of the night and you go to use the bathroom, see the Chucky mask and it scares you 3 times a week. You know, that's amazing.
It's a goddamn orphan. dude. So, Orphan First Kill comes out August 19th.
Yes.
Very excited to see it. I can't wait. I know our people are going to love it because we're orphan heads.
I mean, it's a movie made very much. It's kind of a love letter to her and to fans, you know, of her. I mean, you know, it wasn't just a movie made just to make a movie. It was a movie very much made with, and I'm a fan, you know, with to go, oh yeah, like I want to, I mean, you'll see.
I'll always spend more time with an orphan. I can't wait. Well, thank you so much, Brent. Thank you so much for talking to me today. And we'll put up a little link and I'll let you know when it goes up.
Great, man. Thank you so much.
Live from your grave.
Thank you again to all you Patreon listeners for every single thing that you've done. Now, all of the delicious ducats that you have given from your hot, wet little pockets to our big, wide, cold, dry pockets. And I want to say thank you. Thank you so much. Hail Satan. Go watch Orphan First Kill. I know I'm going to. You know I like this shit. And it's gonna be great. Get high as hell. Drink a bunch of beers. And hopefully that orphan does a little bit more mayhem because God, I need it.